during their initial time together, he taught her the way to move unseen, first through cities, then entire countries, how to train her senses, developing that second sight that now worked like a radar screen in her mind. They played the serious kind of tag in the streets of Paris, where he had contacts in a private detective agency whose employees acted as shadows for him, thinking that they were helping to train Tyro's surveillance officers. He also made it fun, and she would remember the lessons vividly. Foot padding in the Bois de Boulogne, hide-and-seek in the Louvre, then out into the Tuileries Gardens, passing the parcel in the Musée de l'Armée in the Invalides, and cowboys and Indians along the cloistered arches of the Rue de Rivoli. In London, he taught her other skills, the cunning of the sneak thief, the expertise of a forger on the fly, the deftness of a pickpocket, and, above all else, the proficiency of one with eyes everywhere. During this schooling, she first set aside any guilt that remained. If called upon, she admitted that she might herself be able to kill without a backward glance, though she knew she would have trouble with the accountability. This original training had pecked at her antennae in rain/Bern, so that she picked up not only the scent of Rebecca following her in plain sight, but also other shadows that clung to Tessa unseen, but on the periphery of her consciousness. Tessa was totally aware. With Bex following her from Dublin, Tessa was quite clear about what was going on. Lying in her bath, she thought maybe this was the final result of the idiots who had broken security on the telephone when she was at Dublin Airport. So now she wondered if it was worthwhile trying to rid herself of the girl straight away. Leave in a few minutes, get a cab to whistle her down the wind, hop to the next point and rest there. No, this girl was trained. Possibly police, she correctly reasoned, though she could not have told you why or how she thought it. So they might as well travel cheek by jowl. Once there, in Brissago, she could see what Ronnie had to say about it. She rarely called him Ron, a diminutive he disliked almost as much as Ronald. Tessa was ultra-correct in calling and thinking of him as Ronnie all the time. After she dried off in her ensuite bathroom in the Bern Hotel, Tessa had gone over to the window and looked out on the wet, depressing night, and seen along the slick streets traces of being followed. She counted the same car, slowly passing five times through the Bahnhofplatz, a little dirty grey VW, with extra wing mirrors, and a long whip aerial, the license plate partially obscured by mud, but just enough there to note that it was local. How official is this? She asked herself, trying to remember where the nearest consulate had a residence. She heard Ronnie's voice in her ear. In Switzerland, it doesn't matter. They can get people in day or night, easy as pie. And she knew it was true because all security services did it, crossed borders, hired cars, kept safe houses. Had not Ronnie shown her exactly how it was done? So the next day when Tessa saw the girl on the train, she was in no way startled. She would have been more concerned had she found herself alone on the journey. The only thing that gave her pause was the presence of other distorted shadows not seen clearly. Until too late, of course. "Who's that on your tail?" Richardson muttered when he came out and embraced her, lips close to her ear as they rocked together in front of the villa.
"Been with me since Dublin. I think there's others as well. But the girl's been there all the way. There's a lot of movement around, darling. A carload in Bern last night. None of it feels right."
She felt his facial muscles move against her cheek. "Fun and games are off, then?"
"Only after dark, surely."
With a wicked little chuckle, she snaked her arms tightly around his neck, pushing her pelvis hard against him. She worked her tongue into his mouth, licking behind his gums, pushing hard, hoping he would force her indoors and take her before any further dangers revealed themselves. But after one kiss, he gently released himself. "This is how I've survived," he whispered, taking immense care. "You know how it's done, Tess, so let's do it properly." They stood together, far back from the window in an upstairs room, watching as Bex went up the road and crossed over to the café. Then he led Tessa into the garden on the far side of the villa, and as the daylight bled away, She told him about London, the targets, the time limit, and the weapon.
"President and Madame Bortunin," she said,
and he growled a one-note, deep, grunting laugh.
"By firearm, in London during the 10-day visit, the state visit with the Yanks in town as well. That's next week."
"Damn, double damn," Ronnie scowled, his face becoming almost a caricature of itself. Anger flared in his eyes, and his mouth was askew.
"Shots to the head preferred."
He laughed the grunting laugh again. "Old faithful hardliners.
Ukrainians call themselves sons and daughters of October."
He lifted a hand and she stopped muttering. "I know who they are. Well-funded prima donnas." He shrugged. "If they want to build some message into it, why don't they take the risk and do it themselves? Crazy."
"You're not going to do it?"
Her voice had an undertow of relief. "Of course I'm going to do it. It's a job." He paused as though reconsidering. "Tell you what, I'll do it if we're able to get out without being seen by whoever this woman is, and whoever's sticking to her back. Smells professional. I don't think it's a cowboy outfit." He inclined his head in the direction of the road. "You may have to come with me. God, I wish you'd been more careful." Looking at her sideways, not moving his head. "Damn," he cursed again quietly, acknowledging the implications of being tracked down to this hiding place, which he'd loved for so long. Sometimes he wondered if he could have real emotional love for another person, only for places to which he could never return. She put her hand on his arm, trying to draw him closer, but it was like pulling at a standing stone.
"Ronnie," urgent now, "can't we call it a day? Can't we just up and go, leave, begin life somewhere else?"
For a second she thought he would capitulate. Then, "Nope." A shake of the head. "Not yet. Not quite yet." The girl, he confirmed to her, was police-trained. He knew it by the way she moved when she came out of the cafe, by the restless, searching eyes and her looping stride. "Where there's one, there'll be others. But there's something else." His intuition had flicked like the needles on a piece of electronic equipment. There was danger out there. He'd spotted an insubstantial shadow ahead of the girl, moving with a military jaunt. They would not be able to rest tonight, he said. It wasn't just the cop. "You felt it yourself, Tess." He said he could sense it everywhere in his bones and his brain, and she was jumpy.
"It's not just the journey," she said. "Not simply the girl and too much coffee."
This went deeper. "Something else," she said. And he nodded, thinking of the other shadow. "If there are two of them, they'll have some backup nearby," he told himself. Aloud, he muttered something about being alert. Ronnie created a hide for himself in the big bedroom, looking out over the lake, while Tessa watched the front of the villa. Before they began the watch, he called the hotel down by the landing stage. He was looking for an old friend, an English girl, he told them. Thought he'd glimpsed her on the boat, the ferry from Locarno. Yes, there was one English lady, they said. The name? Certainly they had the name. Miss Nightingale. Did he wish to be put through? No, that wasn't the name. He must have made a mistake. Tessa prepared flasks of coffee and sandwiches. There was bread, butter, sandwich spread, some ham, cheese, and a couple of tomatoes in the fridge, as well as the makings of a bolognese sauce Ronnie had planned for dinner. Incongruously, she made neat little triangles, cutting off the crusts, laughing at herself for doing such a thing, keeping the triangles for herself and cutting doorsteps for Ronnie. So they settled down for the long night watch. She sat away from the window in one of the upstairs rooms, looking onto the road, the small two-way radio in her lap, maintaining contact every half hour or so. Between the cars slashing the darkness, she thought of a Rembrandt painting, dramatic lighting, the colours sharp as though she were looking at it through the window. Then, for no apparent reason, she recalled an incident from years ago, heard the words, "Oh, no, no, it's much worse than that," tried to place them, then remembered. She must have been about 15 because she knew what was what, but still went to church with her parents. There'd been a scandal, something to do with the priest having fathered a child. She heard it being discussed in low, urgent tones. As they came out from Mass, the woman in front of her leaned forward and said to the priest standing by the door, "Oh, Father, isn't it terrible about Father Xavier? I would have been better if he died." The priest, still wearing the vestments, a gold-trimmed green chasuble over the alb, raised his hands in horror. "Oh, no, no, it's much worse than that." She'd wanted to laugh, and had to hurry away lest the priest see her smirk. She tried to make sense of his logic and failed, remembered looking at the vestments, seeing the maniple dangling from above his left wrist, admiring the beautiful needlework. There'd been an inevitable row with her mother and father. Later, through a closed door, she heard her mother tut-tutting.
"Silly girl, if only she'd kept quiet, Father would have been spared this fuss. Now she's humiliated him, and maybe he'll be unfrocked."
It had taken Tess a moment to understand her mother spoke of the girl whom the priest had made pregnant. It was an unwritten law at that time that you never accused a priest of such a thing, a habit that had taken long to die. From somewhere else in the silt of her memory, she dredged up the fact that the priest concerned had not been cast into outer darkness, just moved away to another parish, sent to the south. She'd seen him one afternoon, years later in Dublin, a weasel of a man with the shifty eyes of a pickpocket, though he was into picking at things more valuable than those carried in your pocket. In the streetlights on the far side of the road, she saw two women walking quickly, as though they feared the shadows, and she realized that she was carrying a terror deep inside her, a fear of what this night could bring, how it might affect the future. More cars went past, gathering speed, and she looked at her watch, tilting her wrist toward the light filtering through the window. 2 minutes to midnight. In the rear bedroom, overlooking the terrace and the grass sweeping down to the lake, Ronnie Richardson waited. At 4 o'clock in the morning, Lenny Saxby, the unexpected player, rose from the water and splashed ashore, bent on vengeance. He wore a wetsuit and face mask. In his right hand, he carried a waterproof bag that contained a Glock 9mm automatic pistol. In his head, he carried a grudge, almost 15 years old.